Okay, so, well, thank you very much, and it's a pleasure to be here. And if you can't hear or something like that, or whatever, interrupt at any time. And also, of course, it's a very heterogeneous audience, and most of you can probably teach me lots of things I don't know about, all kinds of things, in addition to whatever I can teach you. So I think we should certainly, I'm sure you have the usual policy of interrupting and asking questions and things like that, and I'll try to indicate if it's something I'm about to come to, I'll tell you that, but feel free anytime to ask anything, and especially if there's some term or if there's some idea that I whip by that isn't familiar. It's always fun to talk to physicists and so forth, because more usually I talk to biochemists and biologists, and they always are very impressed if you have two or three equations, and on the other hand, they think if you have these lovely experiments, well, that's perfectly obvious, and the physicists think the equations are perfectly obvious and the experiments seem magical, so I guess it can work either way. In any case, I'm also apologizing for being old-fashioned, having some of these things on slides. I had to, you know, I never have quite enough time to assemble a PowerPoint presentation, so I just take a bunch of slides with me and put things together in some reasonably coherent way. So what I'm going to talk about, since I even had a slide that had this title on it, is regulatory strategies for the control of transcription, and that's going to have really three parts to it. First of all, I'm going to say something about the principles of what a transcription system is supposed to do, has to do, how its regulation. How its regulation will, in principle, makes that possible. Because basically, the transcriptional system, as you know, is the first regulatory system at the level of gene expression, and you can of course regulate things at the level of transcription, which means making messenger RNA. You can regulate things at the level of splicing the RNA and so forth, and of course you can regulate things at the level of translation, but in some ways working the closest upstream, which is transcription, is of course the most efficient, if you like, and so one can so much regulation in biology takes place at this point. And one needs to do regulation both in terms of what goes on a steady state basis, just conducting the business of a cell, of course, and one needs to do quite different kinds of regulation with the same genes when one is in the process of development and the things which really become extremely complicated. So let me talk a little about the principles of this, and maybe I can take this over this way a little bit. Am I getting disconnected? No, I guess. I just wanted to mention these next two slides just tell you who some of the people that have worked in my lab at various times are, where they went, and I'll just point to some of the ones who made particular contributions here. And this will also sort of show you the issues that we work on at various times and in various connected ways in our lab, so you get some idea of what's going on. So first of all, transcription cycles at the overall level of a gene, the work that Tom Yeager and I started on this will be still involved here to some extent, and Carsten Rippey, who is now back in Germany, was very much involved in getting us into some of the looping aspects of control that I'll talk about. You can think about the transcription cycle as a whole in terms of individual movements from one position to the next, in terms of adding the next nucleotide or taking it out or dealing with misincorporation and so forth, and Dorothy Erie in particular and Mark Young were involved in that. We tried to bypass some of the problems in transcription that had to do with initiation by essentially making synthetic elongation complexes, which turned out to be very useful, and Shirley Dalby in particular was very much involved in that, and she's now at the Weizmann. And I'll talk about Kevin Wilson's work also, who's actually just is now an assistant professor in Vancouver, British Columbia, so that's a little out of date. Then the question of what a transcription complex decides to do and how it decides to do it is an interesting matter, especially for those of you who are interested in equilibrium and non-equilibrium issues, because you're always walking back and forth across the equilibrium, non-equilibrium boundary in thinking about this. And Kevin Wilson and Bill Rees were very much involved in that. So I'm showing you this because I want you to know some of these names, and also because it sort of gets some of the topics up. And then anti-termination mechanisms, which is a very subtle control of transcription at the elongation level, where you turn termination up and down, and that's what I'll use as a major example in what I'm going to talk about. And I'll talk about Bill Reese's work and Mark Van Gils' work in particular, and some of the things Jim Godarzi is doing now. And finally, Rho, which is a helicase that goes along and opens the DNA RNA hybrid within the transcription complex, is one I'll mention very briefly, and especially the work of Katie Wallstrom, and to some extent Hans Geiselman will come in there. Now, I received this email from Terry saying, don't just talk on and on and on, and I gather some of the people have, and I will try not to do that. It'll be your job to extend the talk or to ask questions, and of course it may take longer because you do, but I prefer it that way, so please feel free. At the same time, I'll try to be reasonable, because I know it's difficult. It's much easier to talk from all day than it is to listen all day, and that's an issue. So okay, so the overall problem can be shown rather nicely with this slide, and that is that that here we have the DNA, one gene's worth of it, and here we have it can be in prokaryotes and it can be in eukaryotes. And one of the things that we always used as an article of faith and wrote into all our grant applications and stuff was, well, you know, we work on these simple creatures like bacteria and phages, but it's all the same, and don't worry, it'll apply to human beings and stuff. And astonishingly enough, you know, even though we had our fingers crossed behind our back most of the time when we wrote these things down, it turns out to be absolutely true. And that, for example, the structure of the human polymerase and its transcription complex is almost identical to that of E. coli. I suppose once you work out a good thing, you might as well stick with it. But and you can think tell about some of these issues. But the point is that there are subtleties that differentiate these things, of course, and you've heard about some of them in earlier parts of this lecture series. But at the same time, you can think of them in a unified way, and we always thought of them in a unified way functionally, but now we can think of them in a unified way structurally as well, and that's really very satisfying in a sense. I mean, so the principles of how, for example, you get a subtle regulatory system like the anti-termination system I'll spend a little while talking about to work is are really apply and have to be thought about when you think about eukaryotic transcription factors or anything else. Okay, so and by the way, just so you'll know where I'm going in this talk, I'll start with some of the general principles of regulation at this level. I'll then talk about illustrating those principles with this anti-termination system, which sort of has all the bells and whistles that are of interest in this kind of thing, and including control of local concentration by binding, by tethered proteins and binding to RNA and all kinds of subtleties like that. So those of you who like polymer chain statistics and stuff can see something there that at least will look familiar. And then in the last bit, I'll talk a little bit about the structure, still at the cartoon level. I'm not going to show you specific structures because that's, don't tell my crystallographer friends this, but I always find it very confusing, very much easier to think about structures from a cartoon level and circles and squares and this has to do this and this has to do that than to actually see all the little tiny details, because of course you can make something rather specific out of it that way, but that should come at the end, in my view, rather than the beginning, because it's hard to both get the general principles and to think about the details at the same time. But maybe that's just my old-fashioned way of looking at it. Anyway, so here's a prokaryotic transcription business, and people have talked about that in the course and stuff. So this is familiar. Okay, so there's a promoter, which is a particular sequence. There's a coding sequence that follows. And there's a termination sequence, or often more than one in tandem. There's the holoenzyme, which is a core polymerase, which is made of four subunits in E. coli and almost the equivalent subunits in almost every other creature, but two alpha subunits, a beta and a beta prime, are joined by the sigma factor, and those together make the holoenzyme, which then and the sigma factor is primarily responsible, although not entirely, for the recognition of the promoter and some of the initial manipulations with the promoter, which is of course initially a double-stranded sequence, but then you have to open it, so then it becomes an open promoter complex. And then, and of course, all this is in all the textbooks. Now, one thing that's coming out now and is in several very nice studies that aren't published yet by various people, Richard Ebright, Evgeny Noodler and others, is the point that maybe the sigma isn't all lost at the beginning. And in fact, one of the regulatory features that we haven't paid much attention to but may come up is that some transcription factors retain sigma for much longer than they're supposed to, or we always thought they did, while others throw it off at the end of the switch from initiation to elongation, as we thought they did. But that's the consequence of that, and whether that's just merely an artificial thing which isn't regulatorily important or not, it still has to be sorted out. But the party line, at least, and the way one usually looks at it, is that that one of the differences between eukaryotes and prokaryotes is that the sigma factor is ejected early on, goes into solution, and then the core polymerase becomes much more stable. And this is the picture of the transcript. So here's the initiation part. Then somewhere in here at the initiation elongation transition or boundary, you switch into another mode, another shape, another level of polymerase stability. And transcription takes place with the elongation complex, and you get into terminators. And terminators usually work not 100% at one site. And in fact, some of the so-called intrinsic terminators, which are terminators that don't depend on other factors, but only on the sequence of the DNA itself, have two or three positions at which termination takes place. And some of the rho-dependent terminators, which is a kinetic problem where the rho helicase is binding to the RNA, which has been made, and chasing along after the polymerase, that termination can be spread out over 100 base pairs sometimes. So it's quite an inefficient and somewhat messy process. Yes?
That's what about the simple
even simpler? Well, I mean, you think of phage polymerases and things like that.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, they can certainly, they're even simpler, and I'm not going to talk about those because the regulatory problem isn't so great either. They only have two or three things they have to do, and at the same time, they use rather bizarre regulatory features. So I thought to make the talk at least, encompassable within a reasonable situation, I would start with that system, and then. Well, it's not necessarily easier to understand, but there's less of it. Because in a sense, you don't have so many things that you have to do. And the features are the same. I mean, it's just that the way they do it, as you alluded to, that a lot of those polymerases are one polypeptide, and that makes life a little simpler. But they still have to recognize a promoter. They still have to recognize a terminator. And they're often activated by some covalent interaction, and not always. And they...
This
doesn't, by the way, this doesn't have to be waiting. This transition can work reasonably fast. It's just that at this point the transcription complex becomes much more stable. So these features are common to all transcription, and in fact I put this picture in the middle because it applies to both, and if you want to if we want to have a phage picture up there at A prime or something, it would apply as well. So this is a very general thing, yes, as a first approximation. And I'm always accused of saying everything is a first approximation. I mean, obviously, every system, I mean, for example, another thing we work on, and I'll talk about tomorrow that may interest some of you, is helicases. The principles of helicase function are straightforward. I mean, that can be looked at as being straightforward, but each protein system figures out how to deal with these principles in slightly different ways. So the point always is to try to separate the subtleties that from the thing that's in common, but then to come back to the subtleties to learn more about what's in common. This is, standard sort of thing. Yes.
Returning to bacteria, do you think promoter sequences have their own sigma factors?
No. Yes and no. In E. coli, the sigma factor is in fact. There is one major sigma factor, which is called sigma 70, and is quite a large one. And this deals with what people call the housekeeping genes, namely everything that you need to do in normal just living of this thing. There are other sigmas which have to do with which compete and for the core and for the and direct the system to other promoters that are specialized sigmas, and in B. subtilis in particular, which is another bacterium, and which can form spores. The was the first one in which it was shown that in fact this is a system for making many different using many different kinds of sigma factors when you want to make a bunch of genes to encapsulate yourself in a spore or something like that. So this is a regulatory site, but most of the time and most of the genes that are expressed sort of in the normal living of the bacterium are controlled by this particular sigma, sigma 70. And what you say is true, I mean, in the sense that other sigmas then bind to the core and they direct the polymerase to other genes. And in fact, one of the ways to look at all these questions is that there are a limiting supply of free core polymerase, which is in competition, which is being competed for by an excess of promoters, if you like, because of course the promoter can continuously push through the polymerase and then you can already attract another one while the first one is still synthesizing on the same one. And so and then the sigmas also compete for a limiting supply, and so sometimes when you need to insporulate, then you make more sigmas than the company, you know, it's a big mass action system. Okay, so that's yes. Well, no one really has these very accurately, but something on the order of micromolar. So, I mean, a useful thing to think about with a bacterium is that it's about 1 microliter in volume, and therefore, it is? Microliter.
It's about a micron across.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Or have I got a factor of 10 missed up?
Micron across is 10 to the minus 5.
No, I'm sorry, I didn't mean a microliter. I meant to say exactly what you're saying.
One,
yeah.
10 to the minus 15 liter.
10 to the minus 15 liter, absolutely right, yeah. So, sorry, thank you. Very helpful. Yeah. It's always good to have physicists in the house. Yes, I really meant to say 1 micron across, sorry. And the point is that that results in a concentration of 1 molecule per cell is 10 to the minus 9th molar, I think that's right. And so 10 molecules are 10 to the minus 8th, and so micromolar concentration is about 1,000 molecules per cell. And some molecules like lac repressor and so on, which we worked on a lot in the old days, are typically present when they're not overproduced at about 10 molecules per cell, but they bind very tightly to make up for the fact that they are at such low concentrations that the equilibrium they support is, of course, requires less supporting protein in solution. Yes?
Information, so the fact that that's a zone, that's doesn't sloppiness and there's no physiological difference?
Oh, well, we don't know. I mean, it could be just sloppiness, and in fact, in eukaryotes, termination is even sloppier. You sort of, in fact, whittle away the transcript to some extent, and you have, the intrinsic terminators, as I'll show you, there's a window of opportunity for termination, which is about 8 base pairs long, and so and you can shift around in that zone by changing the stability a little, you last a little longer. So there's a probability of losing the stuff at each point. And rho, since it's at least partly a race, which also depends upon the stability of the DNA-RNA hybrid between the helicase that's coming along the RNA and the transcription transcription complex, which is moving along the DNA. It's quite inefficient and it nibbles it away over a but that makes control very easy to regulate because you just fine-tune things a little bit, and I'll get to that. Okay, so I can see why these talks get very long, but I please keep it up because I really enjoy the interaction. The difference here is that traditionally it's thought that of course things are much more complicated in eukaryotes in the sense that there are many promoters and that there are many subtleties of regulation, so they've another level of regulation has sort of been superimposed. I mean, there are additional transcription factors that can control the interaction of sigma and things with the promoter, and of course some of them are the traditional ones that started molecular biology, but on the other hand, like CAP protein and things like that. But on the other hand, as you know, At the eukaryotes, one builds actually a complex of regulatory factors, which includes proteins that are bound to enhancers, so that which are sequences that can be quite far away along the DNA, so that you build a three-dimensional folded system. And in fact, bringing enhancers to the transcription, to the polymerase and so on, involves looping, and so can be looked at as a problem in end-to-end distances in polymer chain statistics. And that's actually one of the things that we've that I'll be talking to you about a couple of times. So you can have activators binding, and in fact, in the eukaryotes, the naked core polymerase is really unable to do anything much at a promoter. It needs all this help, and so to get it started at all. And so that way, by changing the subtleties of the interactions with these things, one can change which promoters and therefore which genes win the battle for the stuff. How many enhancer proteins? Well, it varies. I mean, you know, in simple systems that use enhancers, you can have maybe a one protein that binds here, maybe as a tetramer or something like that. But in other cases, you can have quite a complex here, and that's delivered to this system, which has other complexes coming in directly as vicinal binding, and the whole thing ends up. And TBP is in the middle of all this, and Tata binding protein, and then the whole thing ends up getting the polymerase too started downstream. And one of the things that's really striking, and if you haven't seen it, there's a beautiful article by Richard Ebright in the December last issue of December of JMB, which shows the structures of eukaryotic and prokaryotic polymerase, and shows how all the subunits are essentially not identical but equivalent and play the same roles, and compares those systems. So these cartoons can now be replaced with real pictures of this thing and of that thing.
Are there histones between the activator and the
enhancer site? They can be. And so that can have something to, so in a sense, of course, yeah, that's a very good point, because looping calculations done only from the point of view of naked DNA may be quite far off, because the contour length of this and its flexibility could be very much changed by that. It's not changed as much as one might expect in the few experiments that have been done to look at that. But definitely there are histones to cope with here, and there's chromatin structure, and of course your speaker on Wednesday will be getting into that in detail. Okay, let me go ahead. And by the way, I won't feel obliged to get to the end of my talk either, so when you've had enough, just tell me and we'll stop. I can get you again tomorrow. but I think the useful thing that I've been coming to think about this is, I mean, there's a whole bunch of factorologists in the world, and I know none of you are those, so I can speak about it that way, because who isolate one factor after another, and they provide the raw material for the rest of us to think about. But the question is, what do these factors do? And so I think that the issue I want to address here is, what is it that factors have to do to a transcription complex, and what can they do, and then how do they do it? So what RNA polymerase must do is in one sense fairly simple, and if you didn't have to control it, you could make it function without all these additional components. So it has to recognize and bind to the promoters, which are defined initiation sequences within the double-stranded DNA of the genome. So this forms essentially the closed promoter complex between the whole enzyme, if you're talking in the E. coli system, or the whole schmear, including the factors that exist in the eukaryote. And actually, one thing I should have said is that one of the differences between prokaryotes and eukaryotes, which are also being modified to some extent, is that a lot of this activation stuff either stays at the initiation at the promoter and the polymerase and the pol and a large component of factors, but not all of them, move away from there. While in this case, the sigma factor either goes with the polymerase for a while and then is released into solution. But the idea that you need a larger constellation of stuff at the beginning is the same in both. So let's see. Then the next step in this process is to separate the double-stranded DNA at the promoters, and this is done presumably by the fact that a holoenzyme is, and the site under it are somewhat schizophrenic in the sense that it both binds to a double-stranded region and therefore stabilizes it, but then locally has interactions which are prone to bind to single strands, and of course you have to open the promoter complex, and then you have to start figure out which is the template strand and which isn't. I mean, you being the polymerase, and then initiate transcription and move directionally along the template, copying the template sequence to produce a complementary RNA. And one of the things I'll talk about that brings a lot of things together in my mind is that, because we've thought this for a long time, and that turns out, of course, that the helicases people usually think about are it's their total job as part of a macromolecular machine to open the base pairs. But of course, this transcription complex is an excellent helicase, and it has a helicase activity built into it, presumably driven by it doesn't need extra ATP, so it's driven by the free energy of conformational changes that come about as you bind and hydrolyze the next ATP and put an NTP and put it in as an NMP into the chain. So it's a helicase too. And then it moves along until it gets to the termination site, and the termination site turns out to be a point at which, at least for the intrinsic terminators, at which the whole complex is much less stable. And so there's a possibility of releasing, and it's controlling this possibility of releasing that's important, because it gives you an idea of how much free energy and how much what the kinetic and what the control elements have to be in the system. Oh, sorry. You mean how do they differ from one another, they have certain sequences, like something like a Tata sequence in them and things like that, but they're all somewhat different, and the sigma factors recognize specific sequences within them, so they have some commonality, but most of it has to do with the surrounding residues. I mean, one thing that we talked about very early on, and which seems to be turning out to be more or less right, is that recognition of primary recognition involves interactions of hydrogen bonding groups with the hydrogen bonding groups on residues on proteins and things like that, and so it's very much like the binding of other factors that have specific target sites like lac repressor on DNA. I mean, there's hydrogen bonding interactions, there's charge-charge interactions, and there's but here there's an addition, the fact that one has to have a sequence that you recognize and that you can open. So I'm not sure I'm answering your question very well.
From the same gene, you can look at transcript.
Yeah.
How variable the start site can be. So how accurate is the machine can recognize the start site?
It's pretty accurate, because basically when it binds to other places it can't get the thing open, so it comes off again and tries again. So it's a lot of these accuracy issues have to do with the fact that the alternatives aren't won't work. So basically the stuff tries and fails and comes back and tries again. If you go, it's of course a very delicately controlled process. So for example, if you go below 18 degrees with typical E. coli promoters, they won't open anymore, and then nothing happens. So you have to sort of work in the window between 20 degrees and somewhat higher temperatures, and surprisingly high in one case, but I'll show you that. But generally, and of course for things that live in hot springs and stuff, all those things are shifted around. But there are small windows, which are typically, and there's several points at which something happens. First binding and recognition, then opening, and all those things together make the thing much more specific than it might be otherwise. So the end result is that the transcripts are almost all produced at the right places, start at the right places, stop at the right places. I'll show you a picture of that. Yeah. Oops. Most of it's encoded in the sequence, but it's also encoded in the protein, if you like, because the protein has to take advantage of knowing how to use the sequence, but the trouble is it's not a coding problem of the sort that you're thinking about exactly, because there's also the subsequent subtleties of temporal regulation and the fact that things have, that a series of events have to occur in one after another, and each of them has a relatively sloppy probability, but by the time you multiply them all together to get actually a transcript, most of the others have fallen out because they just can't compete. So polymerase, for example, will bind quite effectively in somewhat artifactual situations to the ends, broken ends of DNA and things like that. But it can't do much there. So eventually it just goes back to the, you know, its equilibrium remobilizes into the pool and there it is. But one of the things that we thought about a lot in the early days and is still very much on everybody's, on our minds and other people's too, is that there is non-specific binding. And almost everything binds non-specifically with charge-charge interactions and all over the place. There are two consequences of that. One is that this results in a pool of enzymes which are essentially mobilizable from there because the equilibrium, there's a non-specific component to the equilibrium as well as a specific one, so that the concentration free in solution is controlled by that. And actually, I mean, I guess it doesn't matter where this talk goes. So one of the issues that we worked on way back in the early days, and I guess this gives away how early some of our days were, but was the issue of how lac repressor can bind as tightly as Wally Gilbert said it did to the operator site, and then can be induced off by the binding of the small molecule inducers, which are, you know, parts of the metabolic system of the lactose pathway. And because we had, various people, including us, had measured these binding interactions, and it turns out that you couldn't possibly introduce enough free energy at the concentration of repressor in the cell to get the repressor off the operator if all you were doing was putting it into solution by binding the small molecule and asking for it to make a conformational change, which couldn't be 100% efficient, right? And so it turns out that the way this control really works is that first of all, of course, this issue, I'm telling you too many things at once, this issue also requires that you regulate the salt concentration in the ionic environment inside the cell very tightly because, for example, the binding of lac repressor, which in Tom Record's kind of terminology releases 11, has 11 charge-charge interactions associated with it, various positive residues in the subunits interacting with the minus charges of the phosphate. The binding constant changes 11 orders of magnitude per order of magnitude of salt concentration. So the whole window of function is tiny, you know, and you go shooting right through it. So first of all, that's part of the regulatory system. But the other part was that the lac repressor also binds non-specifically to various sites on the genome, and therefore the concentration that the amount you have to put in with the free energy of binding of the little ligand, since the non-specific binding is not controlled by the inducer, that amount of binding is much less because then it can go and bind to these other places as well. And so that's the whole genome becomes part of the regulatory pool if you want to look at it that way. That's a complicated answer to it. To what sounded like a simple question.
The double strand opening, do you know how big is the initiation bubble?
Yeah, the traditional number is that you open it from minus 9 to plus 3, which means that it's 12 long, and then it becomes 17 or 18 long. It gets a little longer when you get into the elongation phase, and then it's that bubble that we use the rest of the way. And
would it depend on a DNA sequence?
No. Obviously, when one says, let's say the bubble is 18 base pairs long in elongation, it could be plus or minus 2 or 3, and that can depend somewhat on the base sequence. But as you'll see, the fact that it can move, slide back and forth on the complex almost requires that the bubble is almost the same size everywhere, because otherwise you would have so much free energy involved in the coming closing and opening of base pairs that it wouldn't be able to slide and do what it does, moving on an isopotential surface. And I'll show you all that a little later. Any other quick ones? Yeah. Yeah, I mean, certainly that's a good point. I mean, in vitro, of course, you can have small DNA templates, and then it's likely that's moving. But in vivo, it's very likely that the polymerase is fastened in little factories, sort of to sites on the membrane or something, and then it's pumping the DNA through it. But it doesn't matter because it's a relative movement in any case, and so. Well, yes, you have to find a way of either if you generate, you have to release it, but there are topoisomerases and so on for that purpose. So you're quite right that in vivo it's very likely that the polymerases are fairly well anchored and they're pumping the DNA through rather than the other way around. Okay, I'll get along a little further. Separating, then initiating, and the initiation, which may partly have to do with the fact that the bubble isn't quite yet at full size, and also is that a critical part of the stability of the overall elongation complex when you reach that point is the fact that there is a DNA-RNA hybrid, which is a positive component, a favorable free energy component of the stability of the whole thing. And so when you're starting out, you're less stable, and so that you can undergo, for example, abortive initiation and then slide back to this position again and start over again. And that's one regulatory feature that people are beginning to identify, and that is that some promoters are tend to shed, 90-95% of the start transcripts abortively before they get going, and others are very ineffective at that. And so that's another place when you can have regulation right in initiation. Then you get into the coding sequence, and eventually you have to terminate and release the nascent transcript. And this, as you'll see, is defined by the fact that in this region, the activation barrier to termination and the activation barrier to elongation are about the same size. So there's a window of opportunity, which is about 8 base pairs long, as I mentioned in response to your question, which has to do with controlling that. Okay, so that's what the polymerases have to do. Then the question is, how is it controlled? First at initiation. So as I said, the promoters compete for a limited supply of the free RNA polymerase, and so does the sigma factor, if you like. And if you want to sporulate or something, you make more sigma factors, and that gets into the competition too. And then you activate the promoters by transcription factors, which often is required at the promoter for successful competition before the polymerase can start. Then the transcription factors, as I said, can be vicinally bound or they can be bound at enhancers. So I've talked about a lot of this already. The activator complexes are often turned on or off by the binding of small molecule regulatory signals, and that was the discussion that we had about the inducer of allolactose, which induces lac repressor, was the first example of that certainly, and it responds, and cyclic AMP, for example, binds to cyclic AMP. Binding protein or CAP or CRP, as it's sometimes called, and one of the things that I'm having a lot of fun learning about is one of my new colleagues, Bea Derrymont, who's just a new assistant professor in our places, and she works on nuclear receptors and their activation and so forth, it turns out again, and we've joined our groups together until her group gets to be a critical mass so she can have group meetings with us, and so we as a consequence learn an awful lot about the complexities of nuclear receptors, and they also work in very much the same way. Ligands turn them off, and agonists, antagonists. It's all the same basic ideas, and that's. But as you can recognize by now, I'm a non-apologetic reductionist. But I think it's easier. It's better to err in that direction than the other, because then you can at least make some progress. And if the biology shows you're wrong, you go in another direction. If you both think simple thoughts and let the facts guide you to some extent, you can never be wrong. You can only be incomplete, I think, is one way of looking at it. I mean, so the early raisin ball model of the atom and all that wasn't wrong. It was just incomplete because that was a reasonable model for what they had, and then orbitals and then orbits and all that stuff. So. Stuff you know much more about than I do. So, okay, how is RNA polymerase controlled during elongation, which is where I'll spend most of my time? So the abortive initiation business ends at when you clear out of the promoter and out of the promoter region and reach a full-length DNA-RNA hybrid, and that's called promoter clearance very often. And it can take time sometimes to get over that hurdle, and so that can be a temporal regulatory feature too, as I think you pointed out, Terry. Stable elongation complexes formed after specificity initiation factors are either released or left behind. The regulation of the rate of transcription by template sequence elements and transcription factors, so you have pausing and arrest. And you regulate the stability of the transcription complexes by putting things on which make them either bind better or bind worse. So the only thing you can do to a polymerase, and I think this makes it very simple, the only thing a transcription complex can do to a polymerase, a transcription factor complex, is to make it more faster, slower, more stable, less stable. And now there are subtleties here because, for example, sometimes moving in one direction, the activation barriers you have to overcome in moving this way, if it is an isopotential charged surface, as we've pretty sure it is, are different than that you have to get, you have to rip yourself out of that surface if you want to come off and so forth. So the subtleties of what one means by stability and things like that have to be considered. But these are basically the things that you can regulate, and this is how you can explain a lot of the function of these systems by introducing an element of this kind of regulation with the fact that at every transcription point you have competing pathways that the thing can follow, and therefore you can think about it that way, and I'll show you in a minute how this fairly obvious idea works. Okay, so just to remember who's involved in all this, the central actor is the core polymerase, which is made of four specific subunits in the core in the E. coli system, and the eukaryotic polymerases have equivalent core subunits in Richard Ebright's article, which if you're interested in this, you should write down because it's the last issue of JMB. Ebright, E-B-R-I-G-H-T, has a lot of background information on this subject, and it's probably something you should have in your library of background stuff. And the and then there's the sigma factor. And the structures of some of the eukaryotic RNA polymerases are now known at high resolution as well, and the work of the labs of Roger Kornberg and at Stanford, Seth Darst at Rockefeller and others have done a lot of work. And then there's the laboratory in particular of Richard Ebright, which has done a lot of high resolution cross-linking mutation studies, and Carol Gross has done a lot on the mostly genetically on the sigma factors, and so there's a lot of information there, and so we can now take our cartoons and begin to make structural sense out of them. Okay, so what does a polymerase do? Well, it's pretty simple. It does the single nucleotide addition, where it takes an RNA and adds the next nucleotide triphosphate, which is the one that's required by the template. Template and magnesium as cofactors, and chops off pyrophosphate and makes the chain, the RNA chain, one longer. And one way to look at what must be controlled is the processivity of the reaction has to be controlled, and this is defined in this case as the number of nucleotide residues inserted per binding event. Because basically the complexes are irreversibly assembled at the promoter, and then they move through, and when they fall apart, they fall apart. You can't reassemble them at that position, although that's not true of DNA polymerase, which has to be reassembled every time you reach the end of an Okazaki fragment. So there are subtle differences. But so the processivity controls this a lot, because if you had, we did some simple calculation, just the concentration of things in the cells, assuming you could get it all back together again, would take so much longer than the dwell time at one particular residue that essentially the control of the processivity of the reaction is what's quite critical. And transcription, the dwell time at each particular nucleotide residue of the template is about 30 milliseconds, although there are pauses that are much longer, and the dwell time for DNA polymerase is 1 millisecond. And so if you so this is where kinetics and thermodynamics cross each other in an interesting way, because the structural rearrangements that can occur within that millisecond, which are most of the conformational changes, let it equilibrate at every position before it moves on to the next one, right? But the changes that can't occur during that millisecond then make the thing become kinetic, at least in a sense. And so crossing this kinetics and equilibrium boundary is one that comes in quite often. So that's what this is all about: alternative pathways and kinetic competition for them, and quantitative mechanisms of processivity control. So one of the central features of what I'm talking about is going to be controlling that. Yes?
Several weeks ago, when this came up, there was a question about what controls the rate of a polymerase, and one answer was the concentration of the two nucleotides.
Mm-hmm. But it
is this stall
What is it?
Well, but usually the concentration of free nucleotides in the cell is above the level of the km of that. So that's an artificial way to control it, and we use it all the time, but in vitro. But it's not a good way
can
to.
Can it come to the equilibrium if it's burning very fast?
Oh yeah. The free nucleotide concentration isn't really a problem. And in addition, at DNA replication sites, there are weak experiments that argue that the concentration is a bit higher at the replication fork because the apparatuses that make it's a huge bag of enzymes that sort of trails along behind it. I'm not sure I believe this, but it may increase the concentration somewhat. But it doesn't matter. The point is that diffusion of small molecules is fast enough, so it's not an issue most of the time. But it's a convenient thing because if you go to so millimolar concentrations, it's not nucleotide concentration dependent. But if you go to micromolar or even tens of micromolars, then it does become nucleotide dependent, and that's great because we can often slow things down into the time domain where we can study them. Yeah.
It's trailing an ever increasing sequence of RNA behind it.
Yes.
Does that eventually slow it down?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, and not only that, but the RNA, in fact, gets involved in bacteria, gets involved in translation already. So ribosomes are climbing on and all that sort of stuff. We've made some calculations about that just from a very simple hydrodynamic point of view, and it probably doesn't slow it down much in vitro and under the conditions that we operate, but it could be a regulatory factor certainly, and but I think that there's not much evidence in vivo either. When you look at the rate of synthesis of that it synthesizes slower at the end of the gene than at the beginning. It's about it's a what? Well, it's constant, except that there are particular sequences at which there are pauses which can last several seconds or even minutes, and you can get a rest, and then because you essentially get detached and slide backwards, I'll show you all that stuff. But the sort of the average rate for transcription in lower organisms is thought to be about 30 nucleotides per second. 30 millisecond dwell time, which means about, you spend 30 milliseconds at each point, essentially. Yeah. On the average, but it's very much an average. Yeah.
I'm trying to make sense of that. My question following exactly. I'm trying to transcribe this into RNA. If I and you're talking about the number of nucleotide residues inserted per polymerase binding event as a processivity, which means that there's a lot. If the processivity is below a certain limit, it means that I'm just generating incomplete
yeah.
RNA.
And so that doesn't happen, except at points where you control by making it happen. So it's a processivity, I guess, should be put in quotation marks here. I mean, you can think of some reactions where the processivity, because you can pick it up again and continue, like finding the primer template junction with a DNA polymerase and continuing again. Here it's just a measure of the fact that the let's look at it another way. The probability of falling off at any particular point as opposed to the probability of continuing there. Okay?
Okay, so they would be sort of very sharp.
Yeah, right. And I'll show you some of that. Yeah, right. Yeah. That's in fact, I'm glad you asked that because that's a better way of putting it than I seem to have on this slide. Okay, so in fact, here we are. This is the. So here's an RNA transcript being elongated. Here we are at position I. Here we're trying to decide what to do, at we being the polymerase. You can either go forward and add the next nucleotide, and there's a rate constant for that. You can go backward you can also dissociate, release the RNA, and that becomes termination. And that can be either at the end of the gene if you've actually succeeded in making a transcript that you can use for something, or you can early regulation the terminators where you put off little bits of RNA which aren't useful for anything, but essentially is a way of regulating that doesn't have to require all the regulation to occur at the initiation site. The other thing you can do, which is something that at least some of our early work was instrumental in making clear, and in fact Shirley Dauby's work, who's the lady who's at the Weizmann now, showing and also to some extent Dorothy Eyres and others, shows despite what you read until at least the last edition of Strayer, that RNA isn't edited. It is edited, It's edited just like, very much like DNA. In DNA polymerase, you have a binding site which is for synthesis, and a binding site which is for editing and takes off the last nucleotide. And the probability of moving one way or the other depends upon whether something has been misincorporated, because when something has been misincorporated, it can't bind properly to the next template position to add the next nucleotide. So editing is very much an alternative pathway. You can either make the transcript shorter again by means I'll show you, or you can and then start over. And so this whole thing has to be able to slide backwards as well as to move forwards. And how that all occurs and so on is very much an element of the regulatory features. So I'll show one or two more things. And it doesn't have, it's a little more subtle than that. DNA polymerase has a 3 prime to 5 prime exonuclease, which can actually cut off the last residue and gets the opportunity to do so by flipping into the nuclease site if the preferred binding to the going forward site is been lowered by the fact that you have something misincorporated. RNA polymerase does effectively the same thing, but it does it by a different mechanism that isn't totally understood yet, because there are these factors called GRE-A and GRE-B in prokaryotes and S2 in eukaryotes, which activate a catalysis that, after this thing has slid back, cuts off the... So this then becomes frayed out if it's misincorporated. It cuts off this piece, and then it starts synthesizing again from here. So it's the end result is very much that it has a nuclease activity, but the subtleties of just how this nuclease activity works aren't quite clear yet. It may actually be a binding, my colleague Diane Hawley thinks it's a binding site very much like in the DNA polymerase, which is an editing site, and at that point these cofactors can operate. The cofactors aren't nucleases either, but they activate a nuclease activity within the polymerase, and I'm being vague because we don't know the answer to exactly how that works yet. But to a first approximation, as usual, you're right. I mean, it edits, in a sense, just like DNA polymerase, but in a slightly different detailed mode.
And how many cases are present
in DNA? In DNA or in RNA? Yeah, the hybridization, this is, it now turns out, we used to say it was about 12, and there was tremendous arguments in the literature that some people like Mike Chamberlain said there was hardly any. I think this is over now. It turns out to be about 9. And then under normal conditions in both prokaryotes and eukaryotes, and then so the DNA-RNA hybrid, which is a critical part of the stability of the thing, and I'll show you that later, is in fact 9 or so long. And I think that evidence is from cross-linking and all kinds of things, and it's pretty incontrovertible now. Okay, so what do you do with this from a regulatory standpoint? As I said, you can either increase the rates or decrease the rates. And for example, the binding factor NUS-A, which is an elongation factor, decreases the rate of RNA synthesis 3 to 5-fold, while the binding of NUS-G can increase the rate up to 3 to 5-fold. So you have about 3 to 5-fold manipulation. You can also manipulate the stability. For example, an anti-termination factor may stabilize the transcription complex about 100-fold. And you can destabilize the complex by working as a helicase, which is what Rho does. So all these kinds of protein activities that you've heard about in your previous lectures all are in play here in competition with one another.
And they're all global? I mean, they're not gene-specific, aren't they? There's only a few.
The regulators, well, some are global and some aren't. I mean, the one I'm going to tell you about a little bit more, the N factor, actually works in cis. So it depends on how far away the site is that it binds to. So because the concentration of the regulating protein depends upon RNA looping, as it turns out. And so so in that sense, while things that work in trans, of course, it can work at every level. And NUS-A, for example, is a global regulator, which makes all the Kevin Wilson showed that very clearly, makes all a whole bunches of different genes all go about 3 to 5-fold slower. So, but the next slide, and I'll show you that. And I know you traditionally take a break in a minute, and I'll is that right? I mean, would you like to do that? Yeah. So how do you affect these changes? Well, and I'll just get through this one point and then I'll stop for a while. Depend on the relative rates of the competing reaction pathways. For example, you can increase the rate of elongation relative to the rate of dissociation of the stability, and that'll increase the forward rate, or if you want to call it the make this the reaction more processive, make it move in the elongation direction. Maybe that's a confusing word of use of the word processive here. How big do these changes have to be? And this is really, I think, we started some years ago treating whole transcription complexes as if they were two hydrogen atoms or something, and talking about the activation, free energy of activation barriers that were competing with one another here. And most of the biochemists thought this was sort of silly because you're just making things complicated. Why don't you just say it goes faster, it goes slower, it's more or less stable. But as you all know already, and you'll see in the next slide, there's a reason for this, and that is that if you think about you can figure out how big a change, and this I think is a major take-home factor, by using this kind of a way of thinking about things, you can figure out how big a change a transcription factor has to make in the properties of the polymerase and its operation to make the reaction do what it actually does. Namely, for example, as you'll see, N protein makes the transcription, makes the factor go about three, makes the elongation complex go about threefold faster, and it also stabilizes it by about 50-fold or something like that. And the net result is that you almost read through all the termination signals instead of falling off, because it's a very delicate balance. And the way to look at this, which is perfectly familiar to physicists certainly, is that you can say that you have competitive pathways which are in kinetic competition with one another, because of course you don't come back from these. And so this is why I was talking about the crossover of equilibrium and kinetics and equilibrium, non-equilibrium issues. So for example, here you're in state A, which would be the polymerase being at position I, let's say. And then, but you can do two things. You can either fall off there, or you can, if you just take that pair of activation barriers, or you can add one more nucleotide. And of course, you can look at that in this simple-minded cartoon. Remember, this thing has to have much more shape to it than this, but this is designed to make it very simple. And this is often news to biologists, because so here's the polymerase at this point, and if it goes over this barrier, it makes the thing one longer. If it goes over this barrier, it makes it releases it, and that's termination, the two competing barriers here. And of course, as you all know, because we're just talking about functions like this, change in that result, the change in the relative heights of these barriers, if you're at the bottom of this black bar with this barrier, the top of this one with this barrier, then you have 99% chance of terminating, while the other way around, of course, you have a 99% chance of elongating. And so as a function of delta delta G, the difference in the heights of these two barriers, the termination efficiency is virtually zero until you get to the point where you have this instability and the rates, so that you have this window of opportunity for termination. But then you can regulate very nicely in this window because it's very narrow, and then after that you're out of the regulatory zone again. So and I'll show you exactly how this is utilized by real factors. But I think that idea is one that's worth bearing in mind. And I call it an example of physical biochemical leverage, namely that here, a biologist looks at this and says, wow, how big, and a physical chemist looks at this and says, wow, how little. And so it doesn't take much to throw this thing in one direction or the other. It's sort of is the point of the matter, and I think that's
that's the operating point of the enzyme on the motor on this curve, point of inflection, or?
Operating point. The operative region here is that you have the most control, of course, right where the two delta G's, where the delta delta G is about zero.
Exactly.
And,
is there evidence that really where the motor operates?
Well, I don't know what you want to call the motor. I mean, in this case, I'll call it a motor. Okay, yeah, the evidence is that. Normally, when you're elongating, this barrier is extremely high.
Okay.
And I'll show you that experimentally in a minute. or after we have a break. And elongation is virtually the only thing you can do, because this barrier is about 16 or so kilocalories high, and this one's over 30. So this means one per millisecond, and this means one per month, or something like that, right? Then when you get to the point at which you can terminate, then this barrier drops down so that the heights are comparable. That moves you from way out here somewhere into this region. Then you can regulate, and that's what I call the window of opportunity for regulation. So that brings these factors, these points together, right? Yeah, no, I'm glad you asked that in that way. So this just blows up that one corner picture a little more, so that the termination efficiency goes from 0 to 1, or let's say 0.01 to 0.99 or something, over 2 or 3 kilocalories. In both sides of zero, but notice that the termination efficiency is the same whether the barrier is of a height that the half time for going over it is a week or a minute, because we're talking milliseconds here, right? So basically this is a 20-30 milliseconds is the region where this thing is sensitive, and where if both of those barriers are that height, then you have some possibility of doing something. And I think that's, let me just see what the next slide is, because this, yeah, shall we stop there for a minute and take a break, and you know, if you've had enough, I can stop for good, whatever you, what's your polite, I mean, don't be polite, if you think that's all people want, then we can all right, why don't we take 10 minutes off, and then we'll talk a little more. All right. Okay. Well, let me. I'll get started again and move a little faster. Okay. So basically, what I've of course covered is, as Terry pointed out, is just the introduction, and which was supposed to be about 5 minutes, so or 10 minutes. Let me just show you very quickly, and he said, and I hope that applies to both of you, that what you'd really like to see also is some specific details about things that physicists can work on and things like that and think about. So I'll try to do that as well. I won't give the, use all these slides as I've indicated. For example, there are experimental approaches to altering the relative heights of the activation barriers, and that's what we were talking about during the break to some extent. You can lengthen the dwell time at selected positions by decreasing the nucleotide concentration, so that raises the height of the elongation barrier. You can decrease the stability of the complex by increasing the temperature, and it turns out that these, despite my reservations, my former student Kevin Wilson said, well, let's keep raising the temperature until the thing gives up. And it turns out that we could go up to 70 degrees centigrade before the thing became, and shift the, so this was a good demonstration of the barrier heights being comparable. And that's what we were talking about with a couple of people during the break. Well, their window is obviously moved to another level, but the details of that are still, so there's a problem to work on. The details of that are still far from clear and are not easily detected by just looking at the stabilities of the sequences of DNA or the stabilities of the proteins involved. Good point. Okay, so these are real termination pictures, and what these are gels, which you've seen before, but the way you do these experiments is you run the, you make a series here which uses only 3 out of the 4 nucleotides. So essentially you can have a stall site when you're well into elongation, and then you can go to the terminator and you can see that you get very discrete termination at a very few sites, and this isn't a very good gel, but and then runoff at the end of the thing and very little in other places. And you stop, these are the transcripts, and the gel separates them according to length.
Okay,
and you stop the reaction here at plus 24 because you've only got 3 out of the 4 nucleotides, and it can't go any further because now it needs the fourth one. So you get everybody piled up beyond the promoter, essentially, and then you add the fourth nucleotide, and then away you go, and you ask where do you get RNA released, and the blackness of the band, of course, is the length of RNA. And these, we used to use in the very early days ultracentrifuges and everything, and you talk about polydispersity and everything else, but of course these gels are, for 10 cents can tell you, separate one that's one longer from one that's one shorter, and so that's these gel pictures are sort of second nature to us by this time. So we manipulated this by playing with temperature or playing with concentration. And this temperature thing might interest you, because look at this. It occurs only at the terminator itself, or at the end of the template. And as you raise the temperature, you get more and more termination and less run through. But you can go up to 70 degrees before the thing folds up its tent and dies out, because the complex is so tightly bound that the system stabilizes. Even though the polymerase free in solution, you would be unhappy by 50 degrees or something like that. So, yes, this is reversible in the sense that these are run up to these temperatures, and then the runs are made at let's see, how is this done? Yeah, it's reversible, but if you wait long enough, I mean, even at 70 degrees, then it isn't reversible anymore. But it is reversible, and these runs, of course, are made at the temperatures at which you see, because it equilibrates at every point. So that's right. And so this is just a picture showing this window of opportunity. This is where the RNA, we stop it at every position. This is a very labor-intensive experiment. You stop it at every position. You leave it on a filter for 10 minutes or so at that position, and then you add and you ask how much RNA falls off the transcription complex. It's terminated at each point, and as you see, it's only in the terminator itself that you get the RNA, and then the stuff that gets through is just like before, so it's re-equilibrating again, essentially, and the stuff that makes it through there doesn't know its own history, if you like, because it's reformed. And so the answer of whether intrinsic termination is an option at every temperate position is no. It has to have a window of opportunity at which the complex is destabilized, and in the terms I'm using, the heights of the activation barriers are comparable, okay? Okay, so that's, now what I want to do next, very quickly, is to tell you about a real system, and then, and I'll do that for about 10 or 15 minutes, and then I'll tell you about some of the issues of sliding and stuff like that for about 10 or 15 minutes, and then I'll stop, okay? Is that fair? I mean, and if anybody, you know, has enough, feel free to slip out when my back is turned. Yes? In this case? Yes, I'll show you that. That's the termination signal is twofold for intrinsic termination, which is the termination doesn't have any factors associated with it. One is that you get into a region of the DNA-RNA hybrid, which is very unstable, because there's the most unstable DNA-RNA hybrid is RUDA. That sequence, that base pair, those base pairs are much more unstable than any others. As a hybrid, as an RNA-DNA hybrid. And so you destabilize the complex by making the hybrid less stable. At the same time, you form a hairpin, and that hairpin therefore peels off part of the hybrid by forming structure with itself in competition with forming the DNA-RNA hybrid. And so it's those two things that occur that was the first basis of Jaeger's and my thermodynamic analysis of termination, that we could calculate the probability of termination at each point on that basis. And while it was only about 90% successful for about 90% of the terminators that were known at that time, this was back around in the early, late 80s, early 90s, it was successful for that fraction, and that was in fact, in a sense, an argument for that the equilibrium approach in using thermodynamics that way was reasonable for at least that fraction. Yes?
I'm a little confused. If we go back to that gel that you showed, I understand in terms of destabilizing the elongation complex. You might think that the termination hairpin is destabilizing first, but that's the easiest thing to destabilize.
Well, the net result of all the destabilization and pausing and everything else that occurs is that the RNA is released. And that's what the gel measures, right? It tells you how much RNA is free in solution that's of that length. That's what a black gel and the black bands in the gel are, and the processes that result in that destabilization are in fact the formation of the hairpin, and the formation of the and moving through a region where the DNA-RNA hybrid is weak and so forth, and those are the things that make those barriers the same height. So then termination becomes a possibility. The point I glossed over in this last thing is that you can describe the data that we that I just showed there as in fact coming from this kind of competitive kinetic behavior, and so it makes but that's the end point, and so the events in between are what we'll be talking about in a minute as what occur. But am I answering your question to some extent? Ask it again if you want.
Well, I mean, in a way, yes. I'm just thinking that as you increase the temperature, the first thing that happens is that the carbon makes that hairpin.
No, the hairpin is actually very stable. And in fact, the RNA-RNA hairpin is more stable than either the RNA-DNA thing, and therefore, if anything, you make it, probably the way the temperatures cross over, it may make it easier to make. Yeah, it certainly, these short RNA hairpins are so stable that you can't melt them before boiling water occurs, so that basically they're very stable, and so but there's an equilibrium, you know. I mean, again, that you have the hairpin or the possibility of having it laid out this way, and that's yeah.
You can see the hairpin.
Yes, you saw the hairpin. Do you?
Well, many of us
haven't seen the hairpin. Well, let me back up and I'll show you the hairpin. Sorry, I'm now taking your admonition to go a little faster. So the hairpin is right here.
But does that hairpin ever get in the way of the growth factor coming up?
It might. That's one of the things we're studying right now. In fact, I mean, whether...
How does the growth factor fight its way through it?
Well, we think that sometimes it can step across the base, and sometimes it pushes it open, because rho is in fact one of the world's best helicases. And it's a helicase which works by, that gets into tomorrow's lecture, but it's a helicase which works by, but it doesn't have to be tomorrow's lecture, it's a helicase that works by essentially moving along one strand and shouldering the other strand out of the way, and because it replaces base pair stability with single-stranded protein binding stability, and that actually is more stable than what it opens. So the reaction that requires ATP, just to give you a little preview of coming attractions, is in fact releasing the back foot, and that's been a lot of people have always maintained that what the ATP does is to fight open the base pairs, and you know, and it probably all that probably happens by thermal fluctuations, or at least. Thermal fluctuations is aggravated by an electrostatic, pointed field or something like that, and my feeling is that biology works most of the time, not all the time, by trapping something that God has provided through thermal fluctuations, rather than by distorting it and forcing it into that state to start with. But that's another contentious issue. I mean, people can.
Where's the RUGA?
Yeah, so, well, that's not so easily seen here, but this whole transcript is, of course, the sequence of about 8 base pairs, and it's a moving sequence as you make this thing, is always paired with the template strand of the DNA, which isn't shown right here. But I'll show you that later. But this thing forms in part in competition with that, because you've made one side of it, nothing happens, then you make the other side, and then you can start competing with the double-stranded structure that this would otherwise be involved in when it was laying down this way, right? Okay. Sorry, this is getting so disorganized, but you'll see. I mean, besides which, I mean, this is more fun anyway. Okay, so now we're going to talk a little about the phage lambda as a paradigm for what goes, and using these transcription control ideas, still somewhat formally, with a fixed transcription complex, transcription factor complex, and then I'll say a few words about the structure that it's working on. Okay, so what, just to be very quick, most of you know that phage lambda, as sort of the paradigm of this, can either be in a lysogenic life state where it's sitting in the chromosome and just replicated by the apparatus of the cell, or it says, my God, let me out of here, and then it goes into the lytic life cycle, because at that point it makes its own DNA, puts it into coat protein and so forth. And this anti-terminate, and the way this is controlled is that there is an N protein, and when it's present at very when it's not present only at very low concentrations, you can't read into the region where you make these coat proteins and all these other genes. While if it's present at high concentration, it works as an anti-termination factor. And as you'll see, what it does in terms of what I was talking about was making the transcription complex go about threefold faster and about 100-fold more stable, which makes the barrier to continuing lower than the barrier to falling off. And so, and normally the barriers are about of the same height when you get to a terminator, as we talked about before. So, so the question is first, how do these proteins actually do this? And then, how are the various regulatory features reflected in the properties of the system that result? So, this is just a messy looking. Oops, somebody's ringing. So here we have a kinetic competition where the elongation arrow is very long, the termination arrow is very short, this barrier is very high, this one's, and so you can't get over this one, you always go this way. When you get to this point, you form the hairpin. The barrier, partly as a consequence of that, partly as a consequence of the structure of the DNA, the stability of the DNA RNA hybrid, the barriers get comparable, and then you have a possibility of doing either one. So this regulation, this anti-termination regulation only occurs at the points of the terminator, not anywhere else, because the other points are so stable anyway that you can't do anything about it. Okay? Okay. So, so what it does, how the phenomenological result is that N at saturating levels increases the elongation rate of the transcript 3 to 5 fold, and but you would need about a 400-fold enhancement to make the change that you actually see. So the other part of it has to come with out of stability, and we've measured this part directly. We've calculated the other part. We have to there's some weaker evidence that says this is right, but it makes everything fit together nicely, and by the way, if anybody wants any references to the details of any of this, and especially as Terry said, some of you want to have problems you can work on here, I'll be glad to give you some references, or I can send you a bunch of references that you can post on your website or something like that if you want, so you can look at and see what the actual details are.
The formal definition of anti-termination
is that you read through terminators. Yeah. And so normally at regular terminators, because there's still this equilibrium, you may read you terminate 90-95% efficiency. With the effective anti-terminator, you read through with maybe 95% efficiency. So you flip it upside.
That is
part of the pathway to lysis, because if you read through these anti-terminators, then the downstream, it's a polycistronic operon, and so then you start making the transcript you need and so forth. Here, let me run the screen down a little more. Okay, so this just shows you this is this picture all over again, and this just shows you that this is the region where we've, this is essentially the termination efficiency as a function of the rate increase factor. If it was all rate increase, it would, so you'd have to see the actual terminators, you have to get out to these points, and so you get some of it out of changes in the in the rate, and the rest of it out of changes in the stability. Okay, I mean, it's just this is a fairly simple. Does everybody see what I'm talking about? I mean, okay. And so how does this work? Well, it's a subtle machine that has several proteins involved with it, all of which are one protein of which is N, which is coded by the DNA of the phage, and the rest of the proteins are host proteins of various kinds, NUSB, NUSE, NUSA, and so forth. And what happens is that you make a hairpin, in the RNA, which is a product, of course, of the N utilization region, DNA, which makes an RNA which has a hairpin in this point, and that's the hairpin to which N binds through its N-term, this is awful nomenclature, it's an N protein, and its N-terminus to the hairpin, and so you have, Mark Van Gils, the student who worked on this a lot, drew all these little stop signs, and so we're reading through lots of stop signs, and we can do this by just binding N by itself to the nascent transcript in any site if you lower the salt concentration a little, so it's specific versus non-specific binding again, or it binds selectively to the nut region, and it binds with three orders of magnitude stronger, because N is a remarkable protein. Everybody's been telling you, I suppose, that a native protein has a particular structure, right, and everything like that, and it folds up. Well, this protein in its native form is completely, quotes, denatured. In other words, it's a complete random coil, and when it wants to function, it folds up, and in fact, it becomes totally alpha helical at one end. So for a long time, we were giving the crystallographers these things and saying, why can't you give us the structure of this N? And they never could get any crystals, of course, and the reason was that the whole thing is unfolded to start with, and it only becomes folded. It's the same kind of idea you've been introduced to, of course, but in this case, the folding nucleus is in fact this hairpin. And so, and I won't take you through all the details of...
Do you recognize the specific sequence in the hairpin?
Right. It recognizes a specific sequence in the hairpin, and in fact, it's so critical that there's a GA base pair, GA, which is a weird one, across the base of the hairpin. And when you change that G into an I, inosine, which just has an amino group missing, it already doesn't work anymore. So it recognizes not only the hairpin, but that particular base pair across the base of it.
Okay.
Hairpin... alpha helical structure, yes, they have, and so that structure is now known, and in fact, it turns out that N is in addition a domain protein, and one end of it is its business is to interact with a nut site, and that end becomes totally alpha helical when it interacts. The C terminal end business is to react with the RNA polymerase, and the business of the protein is to interact with the NUS factors and so forth that stabilize all this. Okay, so how do you make so the question becomes, of course, if you wanted to make it simple, you could say that N would bind very tightly to polymerase, and then it would do whatever it does to polymerase, and that would be that. But it doesn't. It binds very weakly to polymerase at the end of it, which binds to polymerase. The other end of it has to interact with the hairpin, essentially, and it's the interact with the hairpin that delivers it to the polymerase. And let me just shoot ahead so that it binds specifically to box B. This is a CD curve. It induces alpha helix. It also makes a change in the conformation of the RNA, but only if the box B is exactly the right one. So if you mutate it, it doesn't work anymore. And it's only that blue part that binds of the N, which is totally unfolded, that binds, and the other part of it is involved, the red part is involved in RNA-P interaction, when we're just activation, RNA polymerase activation. We're just trying to figure out how that does that, and we don't have any answers to that yet. It turns out that the fraction of N-determination activity correlates directly with the fraction of box B bound, even though that's the other end of the protein that's doing it. And so let me just skip ahead to so this is it's a cis effect, and essentially when you're very close, because what you want to do is only affect a few terminators, you don't want to affect all the terminators, so the way it works is that it binds tightly to this box B, and then it's the effective local concentration that's set up around the RNA polymerase paused at the terminator that determines whether it binds to the polymerase or not. And so if this sphere, this volume is small, and you've got 100 nucleotides that you've gotten through, then you have very high local concentration, much higher than the concentration in trans, as it would be, because the concentration of N in solution is only about, in the nanomolar range. And then as you move further away from it, the local concentration goes down and down. It equilibrates at every point, and eventually it doesn't work anymore. So it's a cis regulatory system that controls only certain terminators that are in the region that affect these coat proteins. That
controls the local concentration of this N protein.
Can I show you that?
Is it being made local?
No. It's bound to the RNA. It's at a much, and because it binds so tightly there, and then it swings around, and this other end of it interacts with the polymerase, And so it's tethered, essentially, and therefore, that's why I say it's cis-controlled rather than trans-controlled. It's really quite an elegant system.
In this context, cis didn't mean in the general neighborhood?
Cis means that it has to bind to the actual transcript that's being made, which therefore is attached to the polymerase, while you can put that box B in trans and capture all the N protein with an artificial box B, and then the concentration is much too low to have any effect. Okay? Yeah.
How long is the hairpin again?
The hairpin is about, the stem is, how long is the hairpin? The stem is, I think, 5 or 6 base pairs? Pardon? No, the hairpin isn't destroyed by the protein. The hairpin binds to the protein. The hairpin is the signal to bind one end of the protein, so the protein can be tethered in the vicinity of the RNA polymerase that it's supposed to interact with weakly, but now the local concentration is high enough so you get over the equilibrium constant. Okay? So think about it as a... I'll show you. But think about it as in fact, we're pushing this to the limit, and it looks like it still holds up. One end of the protein is designed to recognize and bind tightly to this recognition sequence that's specific for one particular lambda phage. In fact, this is also part of the phage exclusion business, where essentially other lambda phages have other ends and other hairpins that they recognize. But that's all at one end of the N protein. The other end of the protein, the C-terminus, sorry about all the N's, the C-terminus interacts with the RNA polymerase and does something which we're trying to figure out now. We don't know what it does, but it makes the complex move faster and become more stable. Okay? And that's the only, all the other proteins are there to support that equilibrium, essentially. And the RNA tether controls the local concentration which supports the equilibrium. Okay? Yeah.
So you think if the N protein only binds to the polymerase at terminate, when the polymerase is at a termination site?
No, it could bind all the time, but because of this business, what I showed you with the activation barriers, going forward is so much elongation is well, of course that would only make elongation more favorable. So it could bind all the time, but nothing will happen until you get to the termination site.
But that, I mean, the kinetics are different if it binds right after the polymerase passes. Yeah.
Exactly, and actually that's a very issue we're wrestling with right now. When do we cross over from equilibrium to kinetics? Because when it gets very stable, then it's probably kinetic regulation, and you just read through all the intervening positions because there's no opportunity to terminate there anyway. But at when it's fairly weakly bound, then it's an equilibrium. It equilibrates at the dwell time in every template position, and so it keeps finding it again, if you like, and coming off and on, that's why you can it's at these short things that we've shown that we can treat this as a local concentration effect, which of course means it's at equilibrium, right? Okay, later on, if it stays on, I mean, we've done experiments where we've blocked the thing, for example, and shown that wait for a long time and it doesn't change anything. So, I mean, for these guys, it equilibrates. And that's in fact, a question that's interesting to a lot of people, including us, and we're working on. Okay.
Yeah. One more small question. In the absence of the N protein, the hairpin actually has a mechanistic way in which it helps terminate.
I'm sorry. There are two. There's a termination hairpin which forms right at the terminator, which has nothing to do with this hairpin. I didn't make that clear. It's my fault. This hairpin is the recognition hairpin for N, and it's been left behind on the RNA already. And this is a different kind of hairpin. But you're saying something interestingly subtle, because this hairpin, if it's moved up against an RUDA sequence,
yes,
can be made into a terminator too. And we've done that also. But
discuss the mechanism of the terminator hairpin? How does it actually stop them?
Yeah, I can do that.
I
I could. And in fact, when does everybody turn into a pumpkin at noon or what? I don't. Here I started off being so virtuous, and then thinking virtuous thoughts about getting done in a hurry, and then So anyway, this has to do with you know, stuff that you're very familiar with, which is end-to-end polymer distance business and the probability of closing a ring. And we're taking the RNA and making it stiffer or less stiff by putting on or shortening or lengthening its contour length and showing that it behaves as the 3/2 power of you know that Florey would have predicted from polymer chain statistics and all that. And that seems to work out all right. So the story is still hanging together all right as far as that's concerned. And so this is a plot actually using the RNA parameters for poly-RU, and forget about the blue line, which is non-specific binding, the red line. The black line is for the specific binding, and this is the distance between the nut site on the RNA in terms of base pairs of RNA and the terminator. And as you see, the local concentration goes up first because, of course, it's so stiff that at very short regions, we're talking about less than 10 RNA bases here. And then, of course, it starts down, and this follows the 3/2 Jacobson-Stockmeyer dependence that you're all familiar with, I'm sure. 3/2 power of the length of the RNA between. And as we change the flexibility of the length, we can make that thing, you know, put in different parameters into that and make it behave. Yeah. So this is calculated for poly-RU, and if, for example, you engineer in another hairpin or something to shorten the structure, then the contour length is shorter, and then it behaves as if they're closer together. And if you, for example, I mean, this is something we're just doing now. If you put on a splint of DNA so that you have a region which is double-stranded and very stiff, then of course the effective contour length becomes, then it becomes less effective because the end-to-end distance gets longer. So the naturally occurring distances are for the actual systems with the full stability about 10 to the third, 10 to the fourth. And the regions that we do it with, when we can just use a minimal system and equilibrate, are around between 100 and 600 nucleotides, and we're right in here. But notice that we're talking about concentrations which are 10 to the minus fourth, 10 to the minus fifth, and the normal trans concentration is 10 to the minus seventh to 10 to the minus eighth, or even 10 to the minus ninth. So by local looping, we've raised this concentration way up. And it's only the looped tethered concentration that amounts to anything under these conditions.
Well, when you've got the second one of a couple hundred bases, even if you don't put in any hairpins, there should be some random matches and so forth.
Well, that's right. And so the fact is that the binding constant physiologically of the, if you're at physiological subconcentrations, is such that non-specific binding doesn't occur because the concentration of N is too low. But because the binding constant goes from 10 to the 6th, at non-specific sites to 10 to the 9th, for the nut site of the RNA binding to the N, then you are able to capture it only. I'm not making myself very lucid. The concentration of the N free in solution is high enough so it can bind to the nut site, where it binds with a concentration, binding concentration of 10 to the 9th. But not any place else where it binds with a concentration of 10 to the 6th, because the concentration of it in solution is 10 to the 7th or 10 to the minus 7th, 10 to the minus 8th.
I'm asking this tether.
Yeah.
This is a couple hundred bases.
This tether in the experiments we're doing now varies from between 100 and 600 bases.
Of single-strand RNA.
Right.
So that could form secondary.
That could form that, and exactly, and we're actually doing those experiments now to show that when we form secondary structure, which shortens it, then you get what you expect from having the end-to-end distance closer, and when you make secondary structure that makes it less flexible.
But even if you don't put in any,
there are already some there. Yeah. Yeah. And so this this is a hypothetical calculation, assuming that the RNA is poly-U, and because that's the only one we have real persistence lengths for, and so on, because Inners and Felsenfeld measured that some years ago, and now we're measuring other apparent persistence lengths, because we can't get to theta solvents with real RNA without destroying the structure, and so we're talking in terms of apparent effectiveness compared to poly-U, okay? So this calculation is done for poly-U, and the real calculation would be slightly different, right? And we don't know it yet. but it goes in the right directions when we make the changes that we're talking about. Okay. Now let's see. Let's not spend time on this. So, I mean, the essentially, there's the magnitude of the N-determination, which reflects the free energy that N couples to the mechanisms that modify the transcription complex, and we don't know what those are yet, but that's what we're looking into. The RNA binding controls the local concentration effect, right, that we were talking about. And the range of N-determination depends upon this looping business and so forth, so that when eventually you get to the point where the concentration is the cis concentration is no longer high enough to do any good, and so that then you no longer affect terminators there, and so it makes the effect very local, and so it's another form of specificity control, right? Okay. All right. Now, so let's. Let me show you the last little bit, and this is where Terry and others were asking about what this thing really looks like. Okay, so here's what a DNA RNA, here's what a transcription complex looks like in a cartoon form. This is the polymerase bound on the outside. This is the open bubble of DNA. It's about 18 base pairs long. It's all inside or under the polymerase, and there's a track for this electrostatic track down which this strand, the non-template strand runs, and another electrostatic track that sort of accommodates this. Here's the DNA RNA base pair hybrid. There's an active separation of the hybrids, which occurs after about nine base pairs long. So it is maintained at a constant size, no matter where you are, of about nine base pairs. And the bubble is maintained at a constant size, no matter where you are, of about 18 base pairs. Okay? Now, and here comes the transcript out. And here is the end here, where the next in the polymerase active site, where the next nucleotide binds, the next nucleotide goes into the substrate binding site. The product binding, the other part, the rest of the transcript is in the product binding site. And of course, every time you add a next nucleotide, it has to move out of here. It ends up, of course, extended to here, and then you have to release it and get it back to here. And in the course of releasing it, you can also go into this sliding mode, as I'll show you. That can permit editing and all these other things to happen. So here's the here's where you are when you're at the critical point of the terminator. There's region one, which is the 6 to 8 base pairs of the RUDA sequence, which is the weakest sequence that there is. Of DNA RNA hybrid, so that makes this whole complex. See, the things that are stabilizing the complex are the following. Three thermodynamic components. One is the formation of the bubble, which is unfavorable. One is formation of the hybrid, which partly undoes that unfavorableness and is favorable. The third one is the interaction of the whole nucleic acid framework with the polymerase. And of course, that has lots of parts to it, but we don't know how to deal with that. These gray ovals are regions where there's a binding site of the polymerase, sort of a clamp around of the polymerase that holds on to the positions just ahead of where the bubble is. And here's a binding site for the RNA that's on the polymerase too. So there's those components too. In fact, a hairpin invasion can not only, which happens here, can not only destabilize the hybrid, but can also destabilize this interaction because you make an RNA-RNA hairpin instead of making an RNA-protein interaction. Right? So, and for those of you who like electrostatics and sliding and stuff, this is the rho thing, just another cartoon. But we know this is what actually happens. Rho is a hexamer. It forms a helicase, and I'll talk about that tomorrow. It goes up here and it separates the hybrid, and that's how it. By separating the hybrid, you again lower the stability of the elongation complex enough so you can release. And so that's an alternative way. So you can release the hybrid either by making this unstable enough so that the possibility of release is there, or you can make it unstable by simply helicasing it, which is the other possibility, and that we'll talk about tomorrow to some extent.
Is there a promoter factor that tells the rho factor where to jump on?
There's a binding, a specific binding site on the RNA, which Terry's point was very apropos to this, because that binding site is very unusual in the sense that it's almost 70 nucleotides long of unstructured RNA. And so it binds to the 6 binding sites of rho, the rho hexamer, wraps around itself, and then that's the loading site for rho. So only rho-dependent terminators have such a loading site, so rho can't load onto every transcript, but it can. Okay?
Once it loads, rho is driven by ATP, chases this.
and at the same time this is moving this way, and that's right. And so you only, so when this pauses at row-dependent terminators, it can catch up, and all that's been demonstrated with mutations and everything else. I mean, this is a, there's a lot of background to all this. Well, it's a little like that, yes. So let me just show you what this thing can look like when it slides. I'm talking about the different aspects here we go. So this was actually, some of you read my review of an integrated mechanism of transcription in Science in 1998. This was a picture from it. But basically, what this shows you is, why is it that this thing can move in various directions essentially backslide? So the nucleic acid framework, and this is, I'll stop after this, I mean, just make this general point. The nucleic acid framework is held to the polymerase specifically in only one place, you might say, and that is by the next nucleotide, which sits in a binding site on the polymerase and at the same time interacts with the template, right, by base pairing. Okay, if that pops out of there, then this thing can start to slide around. And of course, it can't slide further this way, because then the DNA RNA hybrid gets shorter, and that's unfavorable. But it can slide backwards, because now it rolls a different sequence of DNA RNA hybrid back into the hybrid pocket. And so it looks like this. And this sticks out, and this now can be subject to editing as far as that's concerned, and that's what we were talking about before. But this at the same time is not specific for any particular sequence to a first approximation, because basically this is an electrostatic sort of thing that only sees the backbone. And as long as the bubble stays of constant size, you open a base pair and you close a base pair at every point. So if you move backwards one, for example, you open this base pair, close this base pair, you form a new base pair here. You unform a new base pair here and you form a new one here. So it isn't a perfect isopotential surface, because the base pairs are sometimes an AT on one end and a GC on the other, or something like that, right? And so in fact, there's thermodynamic control of this rolling back and forth depending on the hybrid. And in fact, a very weak hybrid, as Bob Landig and other people are showing now, is very subject to sliding back. But the you can also do this in terms of barriers. Normally the active elongation barrier is lower than the editing barrier, but when you misincorporate, this barrier becomes higher than this barrier, and then it tends to go backwards. And so this is what a lot of the regulatory features and pausing and so on that we used to think were just, the thing was just sitting there, it's actually a dynamic pause, not a static pause, because it's running around in this in this free form. So, I know there's a lot of stuff, I'm sorry.
The bubble is always like 18 base pairs long. And you mentioned that is due to the fact that otherwise it would change size, it would require more free energy to open up.
Well, cause and effect. I mean, the bubble size is controlled by the tracks, presumably in the polymerase, that holds it open at that size. I mean, the way I think about it, which may be wrong, is that there's a track for the non-template strand, there's a track for the template strand, and so that makes it about 18 base pairs, because that's what it's designed to fit. And in fact, we've been able to show that we can destabilize the a complex to some extent by giving it a smaller artificial bubble, and then it has to force that bubble open to the 18 base pair size. 18 is a soft number, 17, 19, you know, somewhere in there. Yeah. Well, the way to think about it is that the separated strands, there are single-stranded binding clefts, if you like, in the polymerase, which fit single strands but not double strands, and so that makes the bubble stable. Because normally, of course, you have to pay the free energy of opening the bubble in the first place. But if you have a structure that can bind to that, then of course you get your money back, right? By the fact that you can bind to this, it's like I'm sure you see what I mean. I mean, it's like if it's fluctuating open and closed, it's almost always closed, unless when it fluctuates open, it can be trapped in a form that makes a stable set of protein DNA contacts which hold it open, right? Because that's more stable than the original form. And that's marginal, but when you also make the hybrid, then it becomes more stable, and then you get these very high barriers to release and so forth, and that's why abortive initiation stops. So, I mean, you could sort of, I've tried to build you a framework that you can put all these facts into, but of course I haven't given myself enough, or you enough time to just appreciate all the facts. But am I answering your question? How do you get your money back? Okay, yeah, go ahead.
So you expend this free energy on one side, and the other side it closes again. So in principle, you get...
Well, that's why sliding is easy, because it doesn't cost anything. You go over one, you close this one, you open this one. Oh, it's not coupled, because the energy for opening one base pair is small enough so KT can overcome it. So you can try it all the time. And normally, so when you're decoupled from the elongation site, then you can slide around and it becomes a fully random walk. But when you get back to the point where the green stuff is back at that site, if the next nucleotide comes in, then you start going again, but you can't pull that green sequence back any further, because then you're shortening the DNA-RNA hybrid, which costs you something again. So what I'm saying by, we were talking about different ways of getting your money back, but what I mean in this case is that physicists talk about isopotential surfaces, which means that you can go from one position to the next without having much of a charge, much expense, right? And it's because whenever you move one residue backwards, you open an RNA base pair and you close an RNA base pair, and you open an RNA DNA base pair, and you open and close a DNA DNA base pair. So, to the extent that the same kind of base pairs are involved, it comes out even. And therefore, if the barrier to doing that is of the height of KT or something like that, or a few KTs, then it can happen by a diffusive process. And so, this is a one-dimensional diffusion, basically. And I'll show you much more about that with helicases tomorrow, which work that way too. This is a great helicase. Yeah.
To that question a bit, when the blue thing is up, okay, you're talking about thermal equilibrium, which is no energy expansion. Right?
When the end of this chain is not in the binding pocket of the polymerase, then everything.
So it can slide back.
But it can slide back. It doesn't slide back 18. It slides back 1 or 2 or 3. But the bubble slides back with it.
But shouldn't the bubble find a position that optimizes the 18 bases?
And so there are preferential places. But the differences of those between one GC and one AT is small enough so that those differences are overcome by KT, and so it can. But certainly spends more time in some bubble positions than others. But of course, the other thing that you're sliding is this RNA-DNA hybrid, which also has its own base pair composition, and that can somewhat cancel the other effect. So it's certainly not a perfect random walk in the sense that all positions aren't equal.
The difference between AT and GC could be a few KT, and
if you're trying to you wouldn't slide from a. Actually, nature hardly ever makes 18. In fact, the whole system comes to a stop if you try to artificially make a DNA a DNA double-stranded thing that's all GC base pairs. You can't get through it, and maybe that's why it's discriminated against. But for normal sort of sequences, they're all about the same, and give or take a little. And you have sequence behavior here, and you have sequence behavior here, and so all those things make it sort of work out that this thing can diffuse. But when it gets to the point where the next nucleotide binds to the template, and at the same time binds the polymerase in place, then elongation is favored again. Unless you have misincorporation or something, or an arrest site where you can't bring in the next nucleotide, and then you can get into these states. And of course, the end result is very often that you cleave off the bad part, and then you're the end of it, which is now this part, you know, over here. But I think one thing that's misleading about this picture is this red thing doesn't have to be the length of the hybrid. I mean, I just wanted to show you one possible position. It moves one position at a time, which is very important. It doesn't move 18 positions at a time. And that's, in fact, how helicases are going to behave, too, tomorrow, if we get to that point.
So according to this picture, the base composition of the DNA is going to be transformed or transcription of How strong is that entity effect compared to how we use it in practice?
It can be quite strong. I mean, you can have sequence-dependent regions where the pauses, you can pause for seconds and stuff. But, you know, one of the things is that kinetics is an interesting business in the sense that that kinetics depends upon where your window for kinetics is, and you know, when so when the normal pause is a few milliseconds, the normal dwell time is a few milliseconds, then a much longer pause, but that's still only a change of one or two kilocalories in the delta G. It certainly makes it pause, and a second is plenty long enough now to let some other kinetically competing event take place. And that's in fact the way we look at that. And the whole richness of regulation, and I really will stop at this, the whole richness of regulation can be thought about as having to do with the fact that you have these very simple things that you can do to the polymerase, but by doing it in this very narrow range, and because everything is balanced, then you can go in different directions, because now some other pathway becomes preferred. A pathway to termination, a pathway to editing, a pathway to something else, right? So maybe that's a good place to stop, unless anybody has another question, because I've already killed you probably. Sorry about that. Thank you.